Welcome to Code Green, the Climate Smart Health Professional. In this season, we'll be talking about all things curriculum. We'll be taking a look at the intersection of climate change and health through illustrative patient cases developed by climate and health experts.
We will also have the opportunity to sit down with climate health curriculum leaders from around the world and learn how they've enacted curricular change. I'm your host, Joni Silva.
And I'm Natasha Sood.
In this episode, we're going to discuss the impacts of extreme heat and air pollution on the development of neurodegenerative disease. To guide us through today's discussion, we'll be having three co-authors for a case on this topic from the Climate Resources for Health Education platform. They'll be providing key insights as we walk through the case.
Hi, my name is Kelsey Barter. I'm a fourth-year medical student at Vanderbilt.
Hi, everyone. My name is Hossein. I'm a research assistant at the Stanford School of Medicine, Department of Radiology.
My name is Heather Whalen, and I am a hospitalist at the San Francisco VA Medical Center and faculty at UCSF, where I do medical education.
Welcome to the podcast, Kelsey, Hossein, and Dr. Whalen. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. Without further ado, let's dive into the case. The clinical presentation is as follows. Violet Scott is a 76-year-old female who presents to her primary care doctor accompanied by her adult daughters, who are concerned about her recent cognitive decline. Several years ago, Violet first mentioned she was having more difficulty remembering names and faces, but she had no problems living independently. Her daughters report that in the past year, she has gotten lost driving to the grocery store and is no longer participating in activities she previously enjoyed. They're also worried that she is unable to prepare meals for herself. Ms. Scott worked as an elementary school teacher for 33 years in the Nashville public school system, and since retiring, she's continued a lifestyle that includes weekly volunteering at a homeless shelter, singing in the church choir, and often picking her grandchildren up from school. This is the first time she has been accompanied to her doctor's appointment. She has lived her entire life in a Nashville neighborhood that experiences some of the highest air temperatures in the city during the summers. It is also located next to multiple industrial plants and along the city's main highway. She used to drink socially and has never smoked. She also has no family history of neurodegenerative disease. Okay, what else would you like to know?
Neuro review of systems.
Ms. Scott does not report any tremor, abnormal movements, problems with ambulation, or recent falls. She also denies any changes to her hearing or vision or hallucinations. Her daughters have not noticed any major changes to her personality or mood.
Past medical history?
She has hypertension on lisinopril, osteoporosis on alendronate, diverticulitis, history of hysterectomy, bilateral hip replacement, and myopia.
Any additional environmental exposures not covered in the initial history?
She's never smoked, although both her parents did when she was a child. She used to drink alcohol socially, just one glass of wine once a month, but stopped several years ago when it started to make her feel, quote unquote, too tired. She doesn't have any history of exposure to asbestos, animals, or mold.
Is there any family history of neurologic disorders?
No, no family history.
And were there any pertinent findings on the physical exam?
I'll just highlight her neuro and mental status exams. So on the neuro exam, cranial nerves were all intact and strength and sensation were symmetric throughout. Her reflexes were 2+ throughout, cerebellar testing normal. Her gait is slow with normal steps, not wide base, and she had normal arm swinging and turning. On her mental status exam, she was alert and oriented to person and place. She did not know the day of the week or the month, but she correctly stated the year and the president of the U.S. She recalled only one of three words after 5 minutes. She had normal affect and did not appear to be bothered by these memory lapses. And all other findings on exam were unremarkable. So now that you've heard the presentation, let's quickly run through your differential. Is there anything that you'd like to do for follow-up testing?
So it sounds like she might have dementia, and there's a few different things on the differential diagnosis for dementia. The first thing that comes to mind is Alzheimer's disease, which is the most common type of dementia overall, and is especially common in folks of older age. It would also be consistent with her non-focal neurologic exam. Other things that come to mind include vascular dementia, which is the second most common cause of dementia, but this would be characterized by a more stepwise decline due to repeated strokes and could could demonstrate some focality on the neurologic exam. Also tends to occur in patients that have more cardiovascular risk factors leading to stroke. Other things to keep on the differential for dementia include Lewy body dementia. These are all more rare, but Lewy body dementia is characterized by Parkinsonism. And so that would mean presenting with other findings on neurologic exams, such as a shuffling gait, mass facies. It also presents with visual hallucinations that alternate with periods of lucidity. And another more rare kind of dementia that doesn't seem to fit as well is frontal temporal dementia, mostly because this occurs in patients that are much younger, maybe around the age of 60, and is characterized by personality changes leading to loss of inhibition. So those are some things to just keep on the differential, but probably the most important would be to consider what other kind of mimics of dementia there might exist that we need to test for with some laboratory testing. So things that might present as some of these cognitive changes that we think is most consistent with dementia include hyper and hypothyroidism. So I'd like to check a TSH, as well as syphilis and a deficiency of vitamin B12. So I want to go ahead and get those labs and then also get a MoCA, a cognitive assessment, to get a baseline on this patient today.
All right. So all the labs are drawn and they're found to be within normal limits, including the thyroid studies, RPR and B12. For the MoCA, the patient scored 21 out of 30. So as you mentioned, this leads us to a working diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. I want to go back to the environmental history and think about some of the exposures that she had that have been linked to the pathophysiology of Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. Let's start with the extreme heat. Ms. Scott lives in an area with some of the highest summer temperatures on record. How could this connect with her diagnosis?
So the central nervous system is especially vulnerable to heat, which can lead to both acute and chronic health issues. And in short term, extreme heat can cause heat exhaustion, progressing to heat stroke, which is a medical emergency characterized by issues like confusion or delirium, which is disturbance in mental abilities, ataxia or coordination problems, or even seizures. But the long-term effects of repeated heat waves can be even more alarming, as it can cause neurological dysfunction in people who have never experienced it before. And in fact, studies have shown that an increase in the average temperature of 1.5 degrees Celsius can lead to a higher risk of hospitalizations due to dementia. This is particularly concerning for those over 65 years old who are already more vulnerable. And actually, we already know that the global warming and temperature variations can activate pathways that cause neurodegeneration and neuroinflammation. And patients with Alzheimer's disease are especially affected, as they suffer from circadian dysfunction in their core body temperature, which can worsen with ongoing exposure to global warming. So although the causes of these diseases are multifaceted in nature, it is important to pay attention to how temperature affects our core body temperature's homeostasis, as it can actually indeed play a significant role in the development of these neurodegenerative diseases. So in the case of Mrs. Scott, actually, exposure to such extreme temperatures can cause a cascade of complications, which I described earlier.
Wow, thanks so much for going through that. It's scary to think of the ways that extreme heat can influence our long-term neurologic well-being, especially following acute and seemingly isolated events like heat stroke. Are they independent events, or can having an episode of heat stroke predispose to the development of Alzheimer's later?
So when we think about temperature, when the temperature gets too hot, our bodies can't regulate our core body temperature very well, which can be really dangerous, actually. And this can cause problems in our central nervous system, leading to issues like confusion, seizures, and even a coma. And in fact, it can trigger a lot of different pathways that can cause our brain to start deteriorating. So in short, having an episode of heat stroke may indeed predispose to a variety of neurological complications, in the short and long term as the body's homeostasis gets disrupted.
I also wanted to circle back. You mentioned that an increase in mean ambient temperature of 1.5 degrees, and in your paper you note especially during warm seasons, can be correlated with an uptake in the risk of dementia-related hospitalizations in patients 65 years or older. Can you provide any more context around this? Additionally, how does this relate with the Paris Agreement goal of limiting global average warming to 1.5 degrees?
Yeah, so the Paris Agreement is a legally binding international treaty on climate change that was adopted by 196 countries in 2015. And the overall goal was to limit global warming to less than 2 degrees Celsius of warming from pre-industrial levels, so 1850 or so, and to aim for less than 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, because the science shows that above that level, there are more severe climate change impacts, including more frequent and severe heat waves of longer duration. So the International Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, is an international organization of climate scientists who study, report, and make predictions about climate change. And they have estimated that the global population exposed to extreme heat for at least every 5 years at a 1.5 degree Celsius warming is about 14% of the global population, while at 2 degrees Celsius, it's 37%. So this is a 2.6 times difference in the number of people who are exposed and placed at risk. And the numbers increase even more exponentially as we get above 2 degrees Celsius. We also know that visits to the emergency room and hospitalizations increase during extreme heat events, both for heat-related illness and other conditions that we know are exacerbated by heat, including neurodegenerative diseases. And so we also know that the elderly, whom we're discussing here and are more susceptible to dementia in general, are also very susceptible to heat. Their physiologic capacity to respond and be resilient is much more limited. And so not only do we expect increased morbidity and mortality, particularly of these vulnerable patients and communities, we also know that this is going to place increased strain on the healthcare system and can compromise our ability to provide timely and high quality care to people when they need it.
Yeah, thanks for outlining that. And you mentioned that there are specific vulnerable populations who are more susceptible to these heat waves. And you mentioned the elderly. I'd love to talk a little bit more about the environmental justice implications of climate change and these impacts on neurodegenerative disease and other health conditions. How do these impacts relate to things like urban heat islands and the disparities in how heat pockets are distributed even within the same city?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. So urban heat islands are areas that have a greater percentage of what we call built environment. So that includes things like asphalt roads, concrete buildings, and they also have a decreased amount of green space like parks and trees. And so what happens is this creates an environment that is on average up to 10 degrees hotter than surrounding areas during heat waves. So concrete and asphalt absorb and retain heat. And what happens is that oftentimes this heat is then released at night. So you don't get a cooling effect at nighttime like you normally would. And folks who live there don't really get a respite that would help preserve their health and well-being. Additionally, there's very little shade for residents to take advantage of during the day. And this lack of shade creates an overall hotter environment in those neighborhoods and communities. Many urban heat islands are also in areas of the city that were historically redlined. So these were areas that were earmarked as less desirable and thus received fewer resources and development based on racist federal housing policies. And so the result is that many of the residents of these areas are marginalized communities who already have fewer resources, who may be living in substandard housing that lacks insulation, ventilation, or air conditioning. Many of these communities also have highways and polluting industries in their neighborhoods due to historical policies that took advantage of communities that had less of a voice in the government and industry circles who were making these decisions. Finally, these residents may be dependent on public transportation and thus have more exposure to ambient heat and heat-related air pollution as they try to go about their lives.
And that's a great segue into talking about our patient's second environmental exposure, which, to remind everyone, was elevated ambient air pollution due to the proximity of her home and neighborhood to a major highway and industrial activity. So there's a lot of environmental justice connections there. And I'll start off by just asking, what is the evidence of how elevated levels of air pollution relate to the development of dementia?
So in addition to causing rising temperatures and extreme weather events, climate change also contributes to worsening air quality. And in particular, environmental contaminants can be toxic to the brain. And there is growing evidence that air pollution caused by things like burning fossil fuels, wildfires, and agricultural waste can indeed cause neurological problems. At the same time, we also know that air pollution worsens in the setting of extreme heat, and fine particulate matter, or PM for short, with diameters ranging from 2.5 to 10 micrometers is a major component of these pollutants. In fact, studies have shown that exposure to PM from sources like smoke, dust, and gasoline-powered vehicles can cause inflammation in the brain, with the hippocampus and cerebellum being particularly vulnerable. Air pollution caused by environmental contaminants such as fine PM has also been linked to Alzheimer's disease in this case. And this is because the small size of PM allows them to enter the brain through the olfactory nerve, thereby bypassing the blood-brain barrier, which would normally filter out such harmful substances. And regions like the hippocampus and temporal lobes are particularly susceptible to these pollutants. And so while the cause of Alzheimer's disease, they're multifaceted in nature, environmental toxins from air pollution have been indeed implicated in its development. And overall, air pollution poses a significant risk to neurological health, causing damage at a cellular level, which results in significant clinical impairments. So there is growing evidence that exposure to air pollution is linked to an increased risk of developing dementia, and long-term exposure to air pollution has been associated with numerous pathophysiological changes, such as the accumulation of beta amyloid and tau proteins, which are considered hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease.
So it sounds like there's a pretty robust body of evidence linking those exposures with the outcomes that we're seeing. But what's understood about the actual mechanism of action? How does inhaling these pollutants from the air actually lead to this ongoing accumulation of CNS damage?
Great question. So the current research has identified mechanisms like neuroinflammation, oxidative stress, and genetic damage that contribute to neurodegenerative diseases caused by air pollution and PM. However, the pathogenic effect is still not fully understood and requires further research. So studies have shown that ambient air pollution can increase cytokines and reactive oxygen species in the brain. And elevated levels of these molecules due to exposure to air pollution can cause damage to neurons and other cells in the central nervous system, which leads to harmful effects like neuroinflammation, as I mentioned earlier. And although its mechanism is not fully understood, scientists believe that the MAC1-NOX2 pathway may play a role in the response of microglia to these pollutants. So basically, this exposure causes a microglia to get activated, then you get neuroinflammation down the line. Also, I'd like to mention that unregulated reactive oxygen species levels disrupts the central nervous system cellular pathways, and PM exposure can accumulate oxidative stress, thereby impairing the function of proteins and other molecules that maintain normal cellular function. And in doing so, air pollutants can increase oxidative stress in many cellular pathways, including the mitochondrion, but more research is still needed to understand the mechanisms fully. Lastly, I'd like to, as I mentioned earlier, actually, long-term exposure to PM pollutants can lead to neurodegenerative diseases. And one of the main causes of damage is believed to be changes to the mitochondria function, which contribute to brain degeneration. And indeed, studies have shown that exposure to these pollutants can cause the mitochondria to swell, where it leads to decreasing ATP production. Additionally, at the same time, a decrease in mitochondrial membrane potential and mitochondrial DNA copy number in what's called SHSYFY cells can interfere with normal gene expression in many critical cells throughout the central nervous system. And I'd like to just mention for our listeners that the SHSYFY cells are a neuroblastoma cell line, which is a type of cancer that develops in nerve tissue.
Thank you so much. That was a lot of great detailed information and sounds like an area of active research and a lot to be learned. This is bringing us to the end of our case. So we just want to bring it back to the beginning and conclude with Mrs. Scott. How do you convey all of this to the patient and the family in the room? How would you discuss both her treatment options and the environmental element of this equation?
So I think in many ways, this is a case of delivering bad news. So I think the communication strategy is similar to delivering something like a diagnosis of cancer. And I would usually start with sharing that I have some difficult news to give them so that the patient and the family have a moment to prepare themselves to hear this news. I then explain that Mrs. Scott has a diagnosis of Alzheimer's dementia and explained why we think that, that we don't fully understand the causes of Alzheimer's, but that it's more common in the elderly, those who have family history of Alzheimer's, and in those who have associated cardiovascular disease. I'd let them know that we're just learning that exposure to extreme heat and air pollution may be a contributing factor and that ongoing research is being done to better understand this. And then I discuss with them what the treatment options are. And since at the moment we have limited effective treatments for Alzheimer's, I'd explain that we're not able to cure this and we have some limited ability to slow progression, that this is a degenerative disease and that we would expect it to worsen over time, but there are things that we can do to maintain function and quality of life, including providing some medications and basic things like emphasizing good nutrition, exercise, and social support. I'd make sure that they understand from the environmental perspective that Mrs. Scott should not be outside when it is very hot or if the air quality is poor. And I'd share with them some resources that would help them navigate this. So things like the heat index, which takes into account the ambient temperature and humidity to show you how it'll affect individuals, as well as the air quality index, which helps guide people about what the quality of air is in their neighborhood, and to use this to guide trips outside. I would also just discuss what a diagnosis of Alzheimer's might mean for her to be able to live independently and needing additional help in the future, and make them aware that there are many different services available to help support them. And then I just acknowledge that this is a lot to process and ask if they have questions, let them know that we can continue to discuss this in the future and that we don't have to cover everything in the one visit.
All right. Thank you so much. And just to wrap up, if you were to give our listeners just a 2 to 3 big take-home messages to remember about this theme, what would they be?
So one of the first important points is that for all of us to be able to take the best care of patients, we need to understand how climate change, environmental exposures, and structural determinants of health overlap to create increased harm to our patients, such as increased risk of dementia, like in the case that we're talking about today. And it's particularly interesting and important with this case to point out that it's not just increased rates of asthma exacerbations or increased rates of COPD exacerbations associated with air pollution, but also diseases that are chronic, have an insidious onset, and that we don't necessarily know what causes them, but we know that they're an inflammatory process, that this too is being driven by climate change. While it might be more intuitive for us to understand that that heat strokes are going to increase as a result of increasing temperatures, it's important to understand about these more chronic diseases like Alzheimer's disease as well. And then the second thing that comes to mind is the importance of eliciting an environmental history, and then being able to use that information to educate patients on how to protect themselves, on how to best maintain their health, just like Dr. Whelan was sharing with us about the patient that we presented in this case. But for patients, it's relatively intuitive to understand that, again, with the example of asthma exacerbations or COPD exacerbations, that that air pollution affects their lungs, and that it would be wise for a child with asthma to not go outside on a day where the air pollution is particularly bad and the air quality index is high. But taking that one step further, what I found in talking to patients is that it's much more difficult to understand that air pollution has these systemic inflammatory effects that affects all of the organs in our body, including our brain. And so figuring out how to communicate that best with patients and their families is definitely a big takeaway from this case as well.
I would also like to mention that there is still a big gap in the knowledge in the literature about this topic, so more research needs to be done about it.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Code Green, the Climate Smart Health Professional. Thank you again to Kelsey Hossein and Dr. Whelan for talking with us about the connections between heat, pollution, and neurodegenerative disease. If you'd like to read their case in full and take it to your own school's PBL sessions, you can find it on the Climate Resources for Health Education website. That can be found at climatehealthed.org. If you want to learn about more ways that climate change and health intersect and find out more about ways you can get involved, check out Medical Students for a Sustainable Future and the Global Consortium on Climate and Health Education. And if you want to write a problem-based learning case or slide deck on a climate and health topic, visit climatehealthed.org to sign up. This is Jenny signing off. See you next time. This podcast is hosted by Jenny Silva and produced by Natasha Sood. This episode was sound edited by Liana Hagis. The podcast series could not have been possible without support from Med Students for a Sustainable Future and the Climate Clinic podcast at the Global Consortium on Climate and Health Education. We also want to acknowledge the Indigenous lands on which we are recording. Natasha was recording from Hershey, Pennsylvania, which sits on the traditional homelands of the Susquehannock tribe.
I'm recording from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania,
which sits on the traditional homelands of the Lenape people. Lastly, we want to hear from you. Just send us an email at codegreenclimatepod@gmail.com or DM us on social media. Our Instagram is @codegreenclimatepod and our Twitter is codegreenpod. Finally, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review this show. Thanks again for tuning in to Code Green, the Climate Smart Health Professional. We'll see you next time.